There's a moment you realize you're ready for what's next in your career. Maybe it's when you're trying a new scone recipe and think, I could open a cafe. Or maybe you're helping a coworker and say, I could teach a course on this. Whatever your moment is, it's never too early to plan for a career that lives longer. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. For skills training, resume tips, and job listings, visit aarp.org/work.
Cheers to a great day and this ice-cold Corona.
You know what would make this day even better? My grandma's carne asada.
Throw in some music.
We can watch the game. Or we could keep it simple.
Corona, la vida más fina. Get your Corona at ordercorona.com. Relax responsibly. Corona Extra Beer, imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Welcome back to The Savvy Psychologist. I'm Dr. Ellen Hendrickson, and every week, I'll help you meet life's challenges with evidence-based research, a sympathetic ear, and zero judgment. Okay, this week, we will talk about social awkwardness with journalist and author Melissa Dahl. Now, usually, awkwardness gets thrown around as a trait, as part of our personalities, as in, I hate parties because I'm so awkward, or I have a hard time meeting people because I'm awkward. But Melissa looks at awkwardness in a different way, as an emotion. And that is a feeling we can all relate to. It's the emotion we feel whenever we cringe, recoil, or shudder. So for example, we feel it when we remember something humiliating from our past, or from hearing our own voice on a voicemail, or when watching pretty much anything involving Larry David. So Melissa Dahl is a senior editor at New York Magazine's The Cut, where she covers health and psychology. And in 2014, she helped launch Science of Us, New York Magazine's popular social science vertical. Her new book, which we'll talk about today, is Cringeworthy, A Theory of Awkwardness. And I have to say, it is excellent and quite useful, as we will discuss. So, Melissa, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, no, I'm excited to talk to you. So your book is called Cringeworthy, A Theory of Awkwardness. So let's define those two terms. So what is awkwardness? What is cringing, and how are they connected?
Yeah, I was thinking about this. So I think that if I want to kind of differentiate between the two, I think about awkwardness as maybe like an atmospheric condition, you know, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, someone says something, it doesn't even have to be you who said the awkward thing, or that this tension, this like feeling kind of permeates the room. This just happened at a dinner party I was at this weekend. Someone said just a really off-color joke, and you could just like feel the tension kind of like come over the table. It felt really awkward. So I think that's kind of how I think about it. Like awkwardness is almost like this cloud that like expands to like fill the shape. And then I think about cringing maybe as more personal. Like cringing to me is something that I kind of feel internally. It's something I do when I'm thinking about my actions or when I'm maybe cringing at someone else's actions. But cringing feels a little bit more individual, I think. And maybe awkwardness is a little more widespread. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. So like awkwardness is like kind of more public maybe or shared, whereas cringing is more personal. Like cringing is the reaction to the atmosphere?
Yeah, okay. I think so.
That makes sense. Okay. So your book was helpful in me kind of changing or looking at awkwardness in a different way, because I generally thought about awkwardness as a personality trait like Larry David or Michael Scott or Sheldon Cooper. So tell us more about awkwardness as an emotion.
Yeah. So it just became more interesting to me to think about it this way. Like basically when I told people while I was working on this book that I was writing a book about awkwardness, they would say to me, you don't strike me as particularly awkward. And I would, you know, I'd say like, well, I'll take the compliment. Thank you. But I feel this way all the time, you know? And so I think that it just became more interesting to me to think about it as a feeling. Because if you think about, you know, those folks you just mentioned, like Michael Scott or Larry David, I've been rewatching The Office the last couple weeks. And I think we could certainly say Michael Scott is, you know, perhaps an awkward person, but I don't think he often feels awkward.
Mm-hmm.
He will say something that is kind of offensive or, you know, kind of makes everybody else in the room feel weird, but I don't think he feels it himself. So for me, it just became like, you know, thinking about who am I writing for? I'm writing for people who are bothered by this. I'm writing for people who want to kind of feel more comfortable in their own skin. And I don't think a lot of so-called awkward people struggle with that. So yeah, it just became more interesting to me to look at it as kind of an internal thing. Oh, and not to kind of just drone on and on, but we know that emotions are contagious. I can like pick up anger from you and then I'll start to feel a little anger. I could pick up anxiety from you and I'll start to feel a little nervous. And I think awkwardness works that way too. Like I was saying, it's kind of atmospheric. If you say something that makes the feeling in the room a little weird, I'll pick up on it. And so will the person next to me and we'll all share this feeling. So,
And then you and the person next to you will exchange glances.
Exactly.
Whereas if I'm Michael Scott, I'll remain oblivious. So there's a phrase you use in the book that I want you to explain. So what is the irreconcilable gap? And how does that fuel feelings of awkwardness?
Oh my gosh. So I love this. This was something when I came across it in my research, it just kind of blew my mind and just helped lock everything into place for me. So basically to kind of back up, I came across this report from this anthropologist in the 1970s who went to go see this tribe in Papua New Guinea. And he had reason to believe that they had never seen what they looked like. They didn't have any cameras. They didn't have any mirrors. They'd never seen what they looked like. And so he came and he brought cameras and he brought mirrors and he kind of wanted to record what happened. And in his notes, he published this paper a couple of years later. He writes that they ducked their heads and they covered their mouths and their stomach muscles betrayed great tension. And I'm reading that and I'm like, oh my gosh, like that sounds like what I do when I'm cringing at myself, you know, when I remember something stupid I said or did, or when I feel kind of judged in the moment, like I said something awkward. So that made me think that maybe what we say, when we say something makes us cringe, maybe it means that we suddenly are seeing ourselves from somebody else's point of view. It frees you out of your own perspective and you see yourself the way you must look to other people. And this really brilliant Emory psychologist, Philippe Rochat, has this term for this called the irreconcilable gap, which he says is the distance between kind of the version of yourself you hold in your own head and the version of you the world is actually seeing. And I think that moments that make us cringe are the moments that kind of illuminate the fact that those two are not always one and the same.
Yeah, it's like those memes you see online, like what I think I look like when I'm running, and it, you know, there's like this Olympic runner, and then what I really look like when I'm running, and it's this like flailing toddler running, and tripping over her own feet. So okay,
it's the feeling like when you hear your voice played back on a recording, you know, you see a picture of yourself, and you're like, oh no, I didn't know I looked like that. You know,
right? Does my hair really look like that?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So there's one particular concept from the book I really want to touch on because this was so helpful to me. So tell us about cringe attacks.
Oh my gosh. Yes. This was another kind of thing where sometimes if you have a term, it kind of just helps you get your arms around a phenomenon. When I was writing this book, I didn't have this term. And then I kind of was searching online. And this is kind of what people call it online. A cringe attack is basically those moments when just an embarrassing memory comes back to haunt you. You know, it could be years old, but it comes back. And I say this in the book, but when that happens to me, I like react physically. Mm-hmm, like I'll like shake my head and I'll usually like just whisper something like, oh, that's so embarrassing. And I thought that was the only person that happened to.
Me too.
And it is not at all. A lot of people say this. A lot of people I interviewed say this. So yeah, it's you're not alone in it. Neither am I.
So there was in the book, there was this wonderful story. So you write about this acquaintance of yours who was just brushing her teeth. And then like this memory from years prior, like she, I guess she got high on ecstasy at a Halloween party and then like made out with two guys. And like while brushing her teeth, she just yelled at her reflection like, oh my God, oh my God, why did you do that? And like, I was like, oh wow, this is so validating. Cause like when an embarrassing memory pops into my head, it's also usually when I'm doing something mindless, like while I'm bike commuting, like folding laundry or like just something mindless. And then this memory just out of the blue pops into my head and I have a physical reaction and I say something out loud like, no, no, no. Or like, And it's just, it was so validating to hear about this and just not feel alone in this. So that was so great.
I'm glad.
Yes.
Because I'm there with you.
Awesome. Okay. So with that, is there anything we can do when we experience them, or is just knowing we're not alone and that this is totally normal, it's like sufficient?
For me, I think both things have helped me. Just knowing, talking to people that you know, like you said, that you'll say something out loud, or, you know, just hearing that from other people that this happens to, that was so helpful for me, just first of all. But then I kind of tried to dig around to find some things that might help minimize the pain of when this happens, because it's really, really unpleasant. Mm-hmm. So one thing that some research says works is, you know, that kind of your instinct is to like push the memory out of your brain as quickly as possible. But there are some folks who did a study a couple years ago about all sorts of painful memories, not just embarrassing memories, but, you know, actual trauma too. And they say that one thing that helps is kind of like stay in the memory, but to try to remember the non-painful parts. Like if it's an embarrassing memory, just try to remember other things, like neutral things, like what did it smell like? What did it sound like? You know, who else was there? And they say that that is supposed to help lessen the pain, which is interesting. That's kind of counterintuitive. Another thing that worked for me, though, is kind of digging around in the research about self-compassion. And a lot of that research compares self-compassion to self-esteem. And some of the studies they've done is to have people recall like an awkward or embarrassing memory from their high school days. And the self-esteem folks in that condition, they will try to just like pump themselves up and say like, oh, like it wasn't really my fault, or like that wasn't really me, or like it wasn't really that embarrassing. But the self-compassion folks, I thought this was so interesting. They kind of look directly at the memory and kind of let it all in and say like, okay, that maybe that was pretty embarrassing. And people did see, and I am the kind of person who does silly things. But kind of like taking a direct look at themselves seems to be more helpful in withstanding the pain than trying to push it away. So I hope that makes sense.
So what I heard is that there are two buckets of tools. And one is to try to think of other details from that memory to kind of give it more of a context, maybe fill in the picture more so it's not just this embarrassing thing in isolation. And then the second is, like you said, with the self-compassion, is to realize that, or to look at it head on and to have some acceptance around it. So to welcome it in and to realize that it's okay to have embarrassing moments and that everybody else on the entire planet does as well.
Yeah. And so the other piece of the self-compassion literature I should also mention is folks who are high in self-compassion kind of tend to recognize that they are part of an interconnected whole, you know, that nothing they've done is the worst thing ever. Nothing they've done is the most embarrassing thing ever. So that has really helped me. Something that I'm kind of haunted by, I've been writing on the internet as a journalist for the last like 11 years, and I have some really embarrassing stories out there associated with my name. And sometimes those will come back to me. And what I do now is I try to do that, to put myself in this wider context of interconnected online journalists, I suppose. And I just think about like, okay, yes, maybe that story was kind of cringeworthy in retrospect, but everybody who writes online feels this way. Everybody who writes feels this way about things from their past. So that has been something that's been really helpful for me, just to think about it, to put myself in a wider context, to kind of, you know, I'm not that special, and isn't that kind of a relief?
Yeah, that's a really nice way to put it.
There's a moment you realize you're ready for what's next in your career. Maybe it's when you're trying a new scone recipe and think, I could open a cafe. Or maybe you're helping a coworker and say, I could teach a course on this. Whatever your moment is, it's never too early to plan for a career that lives longer. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. For skills training, resume tips, and job listings, visit aarp.org/work.
True or false? Walmart has eye care. True. Stop by Walmart to save and browse top designer frames right where you already shop. And they accept most insurance. Welcome to Easy Eye Care. Welcome to your Walmart.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Okay, so now back to our conversation. So something that I talk about a lot to people with social anxiety, which is related, certainly not the same thing as awkwardness or cringing, but definitely some overlap with that Venn diagram, is so I talk about the spotlight effect, which is our overestimation of how much attention other people pay us. So we might feel like everybody is watching us, but in reality, it's many fewer people than we think who actually notice our foibles or our screw-ups. But it's not true that no one notices. People do notice when we trip over the sidewalk, or we have a coughing fit during an exam, or we have toilet paper stuck to our shoe. It's just not as many as we think. Okay, so that is the spotlight effect. But you brought up a different phenomenon that I was not aware of, called the invisibility cloak illusion. So what is that? And then later, let's talk about how we can reconcile the two.
So I was so annoyed at the existence of the invisibility cloak illusion because I'm writing this book and I thought that the spotlight effect was going to be like, you know, kind of a peak moment, you know, like, oh, it turns out like no one's paying attention to your embarrassing moments anyway, like just, you know, dance like no one's watching. You're great. And then this study comes out last year where these researchers coined this term, the invisibility cloak illusion. And it's kind of this thing where like we walk throughout the world assuming like, okay, like on my commute into the office today, I kind of was on the train assuming that no one was, you know, really looking at me because I'm just going about my own business, nothing remarkable. But, you know, I definitely saw the girl across from me and I looked at her shoes and I looked at her jacket, you know. We all kind of watch each other, but we assume just in mundane moments like that, but we assume people aren't watching us, which is true. But then I was like, well, how do I reconcile that with this spotlight effect, this idea that people think that everybody's looking at them? And the way these researchers did it, because they kind of grapple with the spotlight effect in their paper, the one about the invisibility cloak illusion, they say that basically we just are all too focused on what we're focused on. And we're assuming, like, if I am paying attention to the fact that there's a coffee stain on my shirt, so are you. If I'm not paying attention to myself on the train right now, I'm assuming you're not either. But that's not true. People pay attention to all sorts of things. And so it's kind of just another reminder that, you know, people have minds of their own. And we can't always know what other people are thinking. So, yeah.
Okay. And so here, so even if people are watching, and people have minds of their own and might be paying attention to us or our shoes or our jacket, are they necessarily judging us?
No. I mean, I think that's the spotlight effect. It's kind of the assumption that people are noticing your bad hair days and your embarrassing moments. And invisibility cloak illusion is a little bit more about mundane moments. You know, you're in a waiting room and you're kind of observing other people, but you're not really conscious that other people are observing you. But for me, the way to reconcile the two is, again, just the idea that just because I'm focused on something doesn't mean somebody else is.
That makes sense. Okay. So let's round this out with some useful tips. So what are your highest yield tips that you came across in your research to feel less awkward, or on a slightly different wavelength, to feel more comfortable with awkwardness?
Yeah, so basically I attempted to write a book that was going to be kind of an anti-awkwardness guide. That's even like in my book contract that I'm supposed to write a guide to overcoming awkwardness. And I feel like I ended up writing almost exactly the opposite. I felt like I wrote more a book about kind of embracing this feeling and understanding it so it doesn't hold you back from doing things you want to do, but learning how it can be useful. So I think the irreconcilable gap is something that really helped me with this. I think you can learn to become more comfortable with awkwardness if you think about it that way. If you think about these moments where you kind of do something embarrassing and you cringe at yourself, they're sort of a gift if you think about them in a generous way, because they free you from your own perspective for a minute and you can kind of see what you look like to somebody else. And that's hard to do. We can't always get a full picture of what we look like. So I think that if awkward moments kind of illuminate this gap between who we think we are and how other people are seeing us, then sometimes, not always, these moments can kind of be opportunities to become a little closer towards that person that we think we are, that we wish we were.
Yeah, absolutely. So also in the book, so you did a lot of things, like deliberately, that you put yourself through a kind of awkwardness boot camp. And I don't remember who this was in the book, but somebody said to you, like, I think you've become immune to awkwardness. So tell us a little bit about what you did and what happened as you deliberately put yourself in these awkward moments.
Yeah, that was Andrew, my fiance, said that when I came back excitedly telling him about my amateur improv class. I was just like chatting about like, oh, like, we did 3-line scenes today. It was like pretty big deal. And he just laughed at me like, I think you've become immune to awkwardness. That is the most awkward thing I can think of, amateur improv. So that was one of the things I did. And I did that specifically because I kind of don't love situations that feel unpredictable. I like to feel like I have some control. I'm not very good at thinking on my feet. And so I kind of wanted to do something that threw me into that kind of awkward situation, the kind that felt weird and there wasn't a roadmap. So that's one of the things I did. I participated in this show called Mortified, where people get up on stage and read from their teenage journals. So I read from my 7th grade journal. There's a lot about Hanson in there, as it turns out, the 1990s boy band. Let's see, what else did I do? I visited a professional cuddler because I can feel a little awkward around physical contact sometimes. That one didn't go so well. I kind of cut out halfway through. But yeah, I did a ton of weird stuff. And the point of it a little bit was kind of the idea of exposure therapy, become more comfortable with this feeling and see if it can be useful. And I kind of think it was. I think I kind of came out the other side a little braver, like a little more, like a little less afraid of being direct and just kind of encountering awkwardness and not being afraid of it.
So how can our listeners embrace awkwardness? Should they deliberately do awkward things? Or when awkward things inevitably happen, what mindset would you suggest they take towards it?
Well, one place where I think a lot of awkwardness arises is in the workplace. Like when you are kind of discussing uncomfortable things, like if you're a manager and you have to deliver negative feedback, especially for a new manager, that can feel kind of awkward. Or as I was writing this book, we had a reorg at work and I didn't know who my boss was for a minute. And I felt incredibly awkward to have to ask about that. And normally I would have just waited for context clues to figure it out. But I just asked about it and I felt a little awkward and it was a little ridiculous. But I just think there is some power in facing these situations that feel awkward head on. And in a lot of cases, you kind of just either have to face the awkwardness or you just have to live with the thing that's bothering you in a workplace situation. I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, this whole conversation has been super helpful. So thank you so much for talking with me. And it was a delight to chat with you. Melissa Dahl's first book is Cringeworthy, A Theory of Awkwardness. And you can pick it up wherever you like to get your books. Thank you so much for making The Savvy Psychologist a part of your life. Savvy Psychologist is strictly for informational purposes and doesn't substitute for mental health care from a licensed professional. Have an awesome week, and I'll see you here next Friday for a happier, healthier mind.
There's a moment you realize you're ready for what's next in your career. Maybe it's when you're trying a new scone recipe and think, I could open a cafe. Or maybe you're helping a coworker and say, I could teach a course on this. Whatever your moment is, it's never too early to plan for a career that lives longer. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. For skills training, resume tips, and job listings, visit aarp.org/work.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.